So the Bayesian statistics is how you would actually end up with the probability that something is true, which is what people think they get from classical statistics and don't. So my coin flipping experiment is I take a coin from my pocket and flip it twice. Null hypothesis is an ordinary fair coin. Alternative hypothesis is double-headed. I get two heads. Well, the chance of that happening by chance with the null hypothesis is only 1 in 4, but that surely does not mean that there are 3 chances out of 4 that the coin is double-headed. Why doesn't it? Because we know most coins aren't double-headed to start with. And so the right way to think about it is that you one of two unlikely events has happened. One of them is you drew a fair coin and flipped it heads twice. That, we know the odds of that. It's about 1 in 4. The other is you drew a double-headed coin and flipped it heads twice. Chance of drawing a double-headed coin is some very low number. Suppose we knew it was 1 in a million or something. Once you draw a double-headed coin, flipping it heads twice is really easy. Hard to do anything else. All right? So if you think about it formally, if you imagine that one coin in 1,000 is double-headed, therefore the probability that the coin I just pulled out of my pocket is double-headed is 0.001. If it is double-headed, the chance of two heads is 1. So the combined chance of drawing a double-headed coin and then flipping heads twice is 0.001. All right, 1 in 1,000. Because the second half is a sure thing. All right, so far? If it's fair, the chance it's fair is 0.999 out of 1,000, because almost all coins are fair coins. If that's right, then the probability of flipping two heads is 0.25. And so the combined probability, the probability of two independent events in sequence, is the chance of the first one happening times the chance of the second one happening. So that would be 0.25 times 0.999. That's the chance that I would first pull a fair coin out of my pocket and then get two heads with it. We know that one of those two events happened because I ended up with two heads, and we're assuming that that's the only kind of coin that exists, double-headed and fair. So therefore, we can ask what is the relative probability of those two, and it's 0.001 over 0.24975, is that 1 to 250. So we now have about 250 to 1 odds that the coin is fair. Not as high odds as when I pulled it out and hadn't flipped it. Then it was 1,999 to 1. And each time I get heads, the chance that it's double-headed goes up. But because it's starting very low, it'll take a lot of heads before I say it's probably a double-headed coin. All right? That's the logic of what we're doing. And that's what's called Bayesian statistics. So what does it do? It tells you how to start with a set of prior probabilities, 1 in 1,000 and 999,000 in my given case, combine that with the result of an experiment, and then deduce posterior probabilities, meaning the probability estimates you have after doing the experiment. It does not tell you how to find your prior probabilities. You've got to get those from somewhere else. So you could imagine, in my example, that what I've done is to go through a million coins looking for double-headed ones, and sure enough, 1 in 1,000 is double-headed. I then pick a coin at random from that bunch. That would be a way of doing it. In the real world, it's much more likely to be a matter of judgment. It's much more likely you say, well, looking at all the evidence, this guy could very easily be the murderer. And our test of the bloodstains, low probability that it would be this strong evidence against him if he's innocent. Combine that, and now we're going to convict him. But if you have someone where there is strong reason to think he's not the murderer, such as he's got a really good alibi, then even pretty strong connection with the bloodstains are going to convince you. All right? So that's going to be the fountain by whatever. And as the way I like to put it is no prior, no posterior. That if you don't have some initial basis for a probability, you can't, from your experiment, find out what the probability is, unfortunately. Right? So how to lie, part two. One way is to report sampling errors if it was all error. People understand what sampling error means? Sampling error is the fact that if we at random choose people from this room and we happen to choose him, we're going to conclude that the average height is higher than it really is. All right? And if we do it at random, we choose both of them, we'll get the same result. And if we do it at random, we choose me and you, I think we get the opposite. Mistake. So that's the kind of error that just comes from the fact that you're taking a subset of the total population, and that'll vary. And the standard DNA results are reported as if that was all that was there. If it was just, what is the chance that two random people's DNA would match this closely? And the problem is that you could also get the close match because the guy who did the experiments made a mistake, because the people who sent him in the samples accidentally sent in two copies of one person's DNA instead of two people's DNA. You think lots of other ways it could happen, and all of those increase the chance that you've gotten the wrong answer. Report confidence results with the meaning reversed. Report the probability of what happened given the null hypothesis as if it were the probability of the null hypothesis given what happened. And that, I would have said, is the most common mistake that academics who use statistics and our statisticians make. So, for example, somebody could say the theory that the firm did not discriminate against women can be rejected at the 0.05 level. Done some statistics, and the chance that if they had just been randomly hiring men and women, ignoring what sex they were, that they would have ended up with 15 men and only 5 women, let us say, is only 0.05. Therefore, we say the odds are 20-1 that they're guilty. But that's wrong. The odds of their having done that, if they're innocent, are 1 in 20. But that doesn't tell us how likely it is that they're guilty. We'd like some more evidence. If, to take the extreme case, suppose they are able to show that their hiring was done by some procedure which did not, by people who did not know what the applicant's sex was. All right, you fill out a form, the form is nothing about sex, they never meet you, they've got a bunch of criteria, they choose you. Well, that would be might be enough reason so that even that 0.05 wouldn't convince us there would be discrimination. Or another way of lying, very important way, is you report a selected result. I think I may have just observed that in some online conversations where there was a discussion of happiness research, and somebody was making a big point of the fact that people in Denmark are happier than people in the U.S. and by happiness studies. And he didn't actually give a source. And I Googled around, and one of the sources somebody else suggested had happiness data, and it had 3 columns, 3 different measures. One of which was called happiness, one of which was called something like satisfaction, and I forget what the 3rd one was. On the happiness column, Denmark was worse than the U.S. But on both of the other 2 columns, it was higher. So it's entirely possible, I don't know where the guy I was talking with had gotten his numbers, but he didn't remember, but it's entirely possible that somebody who wanted to make a particular point chose to report the column which gave that result rather than the alternative column that didn't. And there are lots of obviously lots of cases. I think I'm sure that a lot of ads are doing that in one form or another. And as I say, part of what happens even unintentionally is that results that agree with everybody else are less likely to be publishable than results that suggest that everybody else is wrong. Why should the journal run the 9th article demonstrating that the death penalty deters murder safe that way? If that happened to be accepted, it isn't. That's still controversial. I suppose it were. But the 1st article, showing the 1st 9 articles were wrong, that's interesting. All right. So that's going to be a problem. And ditto, if you look at what you see in the press, dog bites man isn't news, man bites dog is. Sort of old formula. And if you think about it, it's not just statistics. I think people have a wildly exaggerated idea of how risky it is to let your kids play out in the yard without you watching them. Because once in a blue moon, somebody kidnaps a kid and something terrible happens. And it's in the news stories. And they don't have the news stories about the 18 million kids who have played in the yard perfectly safely and nothing happened. So one gets, in a lot of these cases, I think, highly distorted pictures of how common things are due to the fact that they're news reporting. And, you know,
sorry, I thought you were going to go on to the next slide. But what I was going to ask is How to Lie Act 1 posted up on the...
I'm pretty sure that was part of either Monday or last Wednesday's thing, but I have to look through it to see. I'm pretty sure I had a How to Lie Part 1. Part 1 included things like you've got something changing a little tiny bit and you only show this much of the range so it looks like it's a huge change. That was one of the things I remember listing in that. And those are sort of the stuff out of the book, How to Lie with Statistics, basically. Yeah.
Can you just explain the 2nd part there again with the confidence?
Sure. What a confidence result tells you is you have a null hypothesis. For example, this is a fair point. That's a nice or innocent. And the confidence result tells you if the null hypothesis is true,
how likely is it that the evidence against it would be this good? So if this is a fair coin, how likely is it that I would have gotten two heads in a row? One in 3 heads, one in 8. Either 2 heads or 2 tails. Suppose the alternative hypothesis is not double-headed, it's double something. Well, the chance of either 2 heads or 2 tails is 1 in 2. If you think about it, because whichever it comes up first, it could be either heads or tails, then you've got a 50% chance the next one will match. And so the mistake is talking as if the probability of your result given the null hypothesis was the probability of the null hypothesis giving your result. So that's the mistake of saying only 1 chance in 4 of having gotten double-headed coins if it's a fair coin, so there's only 1 chance in 4 that it's a fair coin. And that's the way people very, very often misinterpret confidence results. That's why I have a point. Something you'll see done. Now, you have a problem because if you're in front of a jury, you know the jury is not taking this class. If you can find a competent statistician who is good at explaining things, he might be able to explain to the jury why the evidence the other side offered doesn't really prove what they claim it does. But, you know, you can't really count on jurors having mathematical education or knowing probability theory or any of that stuff. But at least for yourself, you should understand the difference so that you know when what people are saying isn't true. And as I say, there's the
The confidence result, it's put it reported in a different form. But the confidence result is a statement about how likely is it that that the evidence you've got would be as strong evidence against the null hypothesis as it is if the null hypothesis were true. As it is. So that if you think about the case where your theory is not as a double-headed coin, your theory is the coin is heavily weighted towards heads. In that case, we flip it 5 times and we get 4 heads and a tail. The question is, how likely is it that we have evidence that good, which would be either 4 heads and a tail or 5 heads, which would have been even better evidence, if it's really a fair coin. All right? Because if you don't think about it that way, there are lots of cases where any particular piece of evidence is very unlikely. But all kinds of evidence like it are very likely. And let's go back to my bridge deal. All right. How likely, you deal out 52 cards to 4 people. How likely is this particular deal? 1 trillion to 1 against it. So I don't know what the numbers are, but it's enormously against it. Exactly as much against it as 13 hearts, 13 spades, 13 clubs, and 13 diamonds. Any specific distribution of cards has the same odds. But why don't you take that as evidence that the deck was rigged? Because every other distribution except the ones like 13, 13, 13 would have been just as good evidence. And the chance that at least one of them happens is almost certainty. All right? So that's why you've got to think about it not in terms of the particular thing that happened, but as the sum of all the things which would have given you as much reason to reject the null hypothesis as you have. So a different way of putting it is you're asking if I reject null hypothesis at this level, how often will I reject null hypothesis that is true? All right. So, as I'm saying, there's the further problem that not only can selection unintentionally distort the results, it can also intentionally distort the results in the kind of context where somebody wants to get published or wants to make a political point or just wants to get in the newspaper or something. And therefore deliberately chooses to report out of 20 different results the one that looks most striking. Yeah.
So if you're working in that 2.5% of the bell curve, the chance that you would reject a null hypothesis is true would be 2.5%?
If your rule is reject the null hypothesis when you're at that part of the tail of the bell curve, if you do that many, many times, 2.5% of the time, if you do that many times with a true null hypothesis, you'll reject 2.5 of them. All right. But that doesn't tell you how many of the null hypotheses you're looking at are true. All right. That's the prior. And then, as I say, you can also just lie, and you ought to be a little suspicious, especially people give you unsourced statistics. Statistics prove that 95% of quote statistics are embedded, including this one. All right. Any questions so far? Let's go on to multivariate. And the simplest, really, version of multivariate is you've got 2 variables,
such as height and age or anything you like, and you want to know how they're related. And a scatter plot's really a pretty good way of doing it, because although it doesn't give you a number you can quote people, it lets you use your eyes. I like to claim that humans come with pattern recognition so good that we can even see patterns that aren't there. All right, if you think about any traditional conspiracy theory, that's really good pattern recognition. Seeing, aha, we put together this fact, and this fact, and this fact, and that proves that Obama was born in Kenya, or that proves that Kennedy was assassinated by the CIA, and that's pattern recognition, taking a whole bunch of data and finding ones that fit the pattern. For a much simpler example we're all familiar with, you look up at the sky and you say, look, that cloud looks like an elephant. It doesn't look like an elephant, but with all the different clouds, you can only find some patterns that it fits. And in my view, at least, there's a reason why we make this mistake. And the reason is that in the environment we evolved in, the mistake of seeing a pattern that wasn't there was much less dangerous than the mistake of not seeing a pattern that was. All right, the pattern is, the reason for that coloring behind the bush is there's a saber-toothed tiger crouched there. Not seeing that can have very serious negative effects. Seeing it means you sort of move away and look a little more carefully. No, it's not a saber-toothed tiger at all. It's just a piece of rock or something. So, in any case, but I think it's true that humans have a tendency to see patterns even when they aren't there. Anyway, if you look at this one, let's look at this one for a minute. What pattern do you see? President Fedya?
As the y-axis increases, so does the x-axis.
That's one of the patterns. And that's the one that a correlation coefficient would show you. What's the other pattern that your eyeballs should show you there? There's something else going on in that particular scatter plot. Okay. That isn't just a random distribution about a line.
It looks like there are two parallel lines.
That's right. It sure looks to me like this is a pretty closely correlated set of points, and this is an almost a closely correlated. There are a couple of experts. So your eye is not your correlation coefficient. Should say, huh, I wonder if these dots are different in some interesting ways. And you can find out. You can say, all right, well, each of these dots represents a pair of, you know, represents a person of whom we've got a height and a weight, or some other thing like that of that sort. And we could look at who those people are, look at this collection of people, look at them. Do they differ? Well, maybe the answer, for example, is that people of African descent, or at least certain parts of Africa, tend to be tall and thin. And so you might discover these were, this is height and this is weight, these were the people of that ethnic group, and these were the people of the area. Or could be other things, whatever it is. Yep.
Here's a book that mentioned independent and dependent variables.
Yes.
So the one on the two different lines that we're talking about, does that suggest two independent variables and one dependent variable?
That's right. It suggests, but more than that, it's just two independent variables, one of which is binary, one of which only takes two values. That's what it looks like. Because it was, if the missing variable was a continuous variable, then you'd get things scattered around. But if it only has two values, then these are one set, these are one set. Right. And the one on the right, as we discussed before, there isn't an average tendency for things to go, for y to go up or down, and x goes up. But, again, it breaks into two different groups, one of which looks as though it's got a negative correlation, and one of which looks as though it's got a positive correlation. And there again, you're on. Correlation coefficient won't tell you that. The correlation coefficient for that data is going to be close to zero. But your eye will tell you that. So that's the respect to which a scatter plot, even though in a sense less mathematically sophisticated than regression analysis or correlation coefficients, in some ways is more informative. Because you've got in some ways better software than your computer does. Because your software was designed by evolution over many, many millions of years, long predating our species, to do the very, very hard problem of figuring out the world around you from the incoming data. This is one of many cases where people started trying to do serious artificial intelligence. They discovered how much smarter humans are than they thought they were. That it sort of seems pretty obvious if you've got a video camera or the equivalent, and it'll tell you, you know, there's a dot here, a dot here, a dot here. Why can't I figure out from that there's a guy walking through the room? Because you're not seeing a guy walking through the room. You're seeing a pattern of dots. And it's a fairly complicated, difficult problem, which we all solve in places where our mind doesn't see it, in between our retina and our brain, as it were, or retina and our consciousness at least, solves the problem of converting the world into a picture of a world instead of a bunch of incoming different colored dots, essentially. Anyway, so that's in a sense part of why we've got pattern recognition. So correlation coefficients.
Two characteristics such as height and weight, etc., and we want to know how they're related, and the correlation coefficient tells you how consistently it's true that when one variable is above its average, the other one is, or below for a negative correlation.
All right, that's all it is doing. And a 1 is a perfect positive correlation that corresponds to a straight line slope up, and a negative 1 is a perfect negative correlation. 0 is no correlation, but as in the second example there, that doesn't mean no relationship. It just means relationship isn't linear. All right. So this is the same thing we saw before. Coefficient from minus 1 to 1. Sine tells you whether the larger than average values of one variable imply larger or smaller than the other. And the magnitude tells you how close the relationship is, but not what the slope is. So that the one on the left has a higher slope but a lower correlation coefficient because it's not as tightly linear. I'm going to go over the mathematical definition. I'll skip the mathematical definition. We did it once. I'm pretty sure it's in the book. But that's just saying more precisely how it's calculated. Correlation need not be causation because there could be a third variable. And you might have a case where there is causation and you don't have correlation because there's something else pushing the other. And as in both of these examples, now a somewhat different one, causation may not lead to correlation, because those are cases where it's pretty clear there's a relation between the two variables, but it's not a correlation coefficient relation. And I decided to label the left axis. That's mortality. I made up the numbers, of course, but that's mortality versus arsenic consumption. Any guess what's going on? Should stretch out much more. Yeah. Arsenic is a trace mineral. You need a little bit of arsenic to be healthy. Just a very little bit. So what I was trying to... I didn't draw that graph. I just added the labels, which I thought was sort of fun. But you can imagine a case where if you were consuming zero arsenic, you'd be at serious risk of dying from shortage of a trace mineral. If you consume a tiny bit of arsenic, that risk goes down. When you consume more than that tiny amount, it starts going up again. And, of course, if you keep going, it's going to be way up here somewhere on that graph. So correlation can be used to predict. Correlation says if this variable is high, that one will be high. That doesn't depend on causation. But you have to be a little careful because if you are wrong about why they're related, you might make some sort of indirect predictions that aren't true. For example, taller adults are less likely to have born children than shorter adults are due to the fact that women bear children and women on average are shorter than men. But taller females are not, as far as I know, more likely to have born children. If it hadn't occurred to you that was going on, you'd happen to be looking at a population of females and say, aha, the ones who will have high, lots of kids are going to be the tall ones, and you'd be wrong. You also might get the policy wrong if you're using these statistical data to say, what should I do? Well, high correlation between dying and being in the hospital, so the obvious conclusion is that when you get sick, the last place you want to go is the hospital. That's wrong. Probably wrong. Hospitals can be dangerous, but on the whole, the reason is not because being in the hospital causes you to be sick, but because being sick causes you to be in the hospital. Alright, causation happens. Alright, linear regression is one step fancier than correlation coefficient. The linear regression is not merely saying how close to linear it is, but what's the line it's close to. Alright, so you're actually calculating the line. And the way you're defining it is that you want to find the line which minimizes the sum square error. All right, this is the error. This is what's called the residual, the amount by which this is off the value it would be on the line. This is the error here. Notice that it's not the distance from the line, because what the residual is defined is the difference between the value that is predicted from x and the actual observed value of y that goes. So sum the square of this, the square of this, the square of this, the square of this, etc.
find a line where that's not as false. And that's the definition that's used for convenient for linear regression for saying it was close to it.
What did you say the name of that error?
Residual.
Residual error?
Yeah, it's called the residual. We'll be getting the residuals at some point. You could imagine plotting on another graph the residuals. All right? You would plot this number, then this number, so it would be positive, then a negative, then a positive at some point. And that's sometimes important for reasons we discussed.
Yeah. And so what does that show once you plot, once you get the numbers?
What this shows is, in some average sense, what is the line that they roughly follow. Or putting it differently, on average, if you increase x by 1, how much do you increase y by? That's the slope of the line. Right? On average, if x was 0, where would y be? That's the intercept of the line. That's just here. So this is the equation, is y equals a plus bx. A is what you get when x is 0. And b is how much y goes up as x goes up. That's what a linear regression is showing. And that one, as you can see, unlike the correlation coefficient, that tells you how steep. Well, once you've done it, you can look at the B, and that will tell you not just is it close. The A and the B don't tell you how good a fit it is. We'll get to that in a minute. What they tell you is what is the line they are fit to. Is it fit to? All right? Different piece of information.
Sorry?
Yes?
Stepping back, like, only one or two
right.
slides. If you have a negative correlation coefficient of negative... I'm sorry. If you have a correlation coefficient of negative 1...
Yes.
That's a perfect line...
Slowing down.
Slowing down.
That's right. It perfectly fits the line slowing down. Correct. And this is getting a little mathematical, but the measure we use, not for the line, but for how closely it fits the line, is what's called R-squared. And R-squared is a measure of how much of the variation of y you're explaining with your line. So what's the total variation of y? We'll just say, for each point, the average value of y and the value of that point. How much does it vary above its average? Sum those squared, that gives you your total variation. Now you say, sum the squared residuals. Take your line and say, how much does each point vary from what the line predicts it should be? If the line perfectly fitted the point, that would be zero, right? The line perfectly fitted the points, then there would be residuals would all be zero, sum squared deviation from the line would be zero, and then total sum squared minus sum of squared residuals would be simply total sum squared divided by total sum squared down 1. So R squared of 1 means the line perfectly explains. Just like correlation coefficient of 1, except that as it happens, R squared is the square of correlation coefficient, which isn't surprising because the correlation coefficient is called R. That for some reason it's a small honor, it's a capital honor. But so they aren't the same number, but they work the same way. Except that R squared being a square is always positive. So if you have the perfect fit to a negative line, that would also be R squared of 1. Alright? And you can then measure how good your fit is by essentially how high you are.
Think of that as how much of the variation of y is being explained by this regression. That's sort of ordinary language, rather approximate way of putting it. Question? So, R squared, that's what I've just been saying, that R squared is a measure of how much of the variance about the mean is explained by the regression line. Zero means that the regression line does no better than if you just had a flat line saying y is always the same thing as the best I can do. Right? R squared of 1 is explaining all of it, measure of goodness of fit, b is the slope, and nowadays you can get a program for the regression. And I was pretty sure Excel would do it, and so an hour or so ago I decided to try, so I made two columns of numbers, one of which was 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and the other of which was the first column, plus a random number for error. And I tried to get Excel to do this to the regression, and I concluded that Excel will then do the regression, but I'd have to spend half an hour or 45 minutes figuring out how the hell to do it, because the instruction, it's even the functions. There's a function for doing the regression, but I'm not quite sure what that function outputs. It behaves sort of weirdly, because I hadn't understand it, and I wasn't sufficiently ambitious to figure it out. So.
but it is true that it, do all of you have Excel? Is that sort of standard? If you're cheap and don't have Excel, as you may know, OpenOffice is an open source equivalent of Microsoft Office. Indeed, as far as I can tell, it is better than Microsoft Office because it contains two very useful function modules that Office does not have. It's got a drawing module, so if you want to draw figures, real figures, not just, you know, things for ourselves, you grab something, if you want to be able to do freehand drawing, all sorts of complicated stuff. The drawing thing in OpenOffice is quite nice. Took me a little while to get used to it, but I'm using it now. And it also has a database. All free. And if you're using a Macintosh, I think NeoOffice is a fork of Office in OpenOffice. Do you know what a fork means in this context? You have an open source project. An open source project has no way of compelling people to all do the same thing. So the usual procedure is that somebody is running the open source project. When you modify the software, you add some additional feature to the software, you send that to them. And they decide whether to include it in the code base. If they include it in the code base, then the next guy who modifies things starts with that included. Suppose that you've got these really good ideas for modifying the program, and you keep sending them in, and the guy who's controlling the code base keeps saying, I don't want that, I don't like that. You've got the option, since it's open source, to say, well, I'm going to fork. Theirs they call OpenOffice. Mine is NeoOffice. NeoOffice is what OpenOffice was a month ago plus my changes. And if my changes are good ones, I can get some other people involved, and they'll say, we're going to work on NeoOffice instead of OpenOffice, and now the project is forked. And I don't know any of the history of this case, but there is an OpenOffice for the Mac, but for whatever reason, I've been using NeoOffice, which is a fork only for the Mac, and I like it, so I haven't looked at the differences between the two. And it's free.
For the R squared to be reported in terms that you, in units or quantities that the graph is?
The R squared is a pure number. If you notice, if we go back a moment, R squared was the ratio of two numbers. TSS over TSS has got to be a pure number, but it's all units.
Okay, so
it's just a number between 0 and 1.
So R squared will always be between 0 and 1.
Has no units at all. It is a percentage of something explained, a fraction of something explained. Yeah. Now, tracking units, by the way, I don't know how many, probably I don't know any of you have a background in sort of engineering physics stuff, but a useful way of avoiding certain kinds of mistakes is to keep track of units. So that, you know, if you've got miles per hour times hours, that ought to be miles. And if you're doing a problem and the final result should be a distance, and you come up with a number of seconds, you've made a mistake. So that's a way of spotting such mistakes. All right. The residuals, as we mentioned, are the distance above or below the line. They will show you which points don't fit the pattern. And one of the things you could do, if you had the graph of residuals, what I was studying before for those two lines we had, you could take the residuals and say, well, look, here are the ones from the upper line. And funny thing, their residuals are all positive because they're above the average line of two. Here, these are all negative. I wonder what those are. Let's ask my program to cover all people who call themselves black, red, and all people who call themselves white, yellow. Not random distribution. That can't be it. Let's get it to color all men red and all women yellow. Ha! Right, so you can see how by, in some way, examining the residuals, you can sometimes spot what's happening. Now, there's something else you could also spot. Suppose what you observed with the residuals was not the kind of pattern we've been discussing before, but a different sort of pattern. Let me pull out one of these. Suppose the pattern you observed with the residuals was that they went something like that would suggest to you that there's something going on beyond the linear relationship, and that something is oscillatory. It might be a sine wave. Maybe it might be something else, but it gives you some idea of the fact that it's not just random error that's making it not fit the line. There is something else going on because your eyes can see the pattern. All right, yep.
Is it possible for all the outliers to be for all the residuals to be positive?
If they were all positive, then simply raising the line up would reduce the sum of squared errors and therefore would improve the fit. So no.
What if the plot was kind of like a straight line, except for one guy who's like up here. How would their regression line look like?
That is, sure. That's lucky. Try that. So suppose what we had was x, 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 x. That's the starch way. All right? And the regression line is going to have to somehow take account of both of those, so it'll go something vaguely like that. It's been pulled up by that extreme one. And if that extreme one were way out here, it would pull the line up more in terms of slope, because it would have, as it were, more leverage in the sense that the farther out it is, the bigger the deviation from this line is. You're trying to minimize some square deviations. So if you then looked at the residuals for this, you would see a minus, minus, somewhat bigger minus, somewhat smaller minus, big positive. And you would then suspect there's something wrong about that point. That's an outlier. And there, I think there's the question here is, does the fact that she is outside of the range, her weight is much higher than anybody else's, does that also imply that she's an outlier? She's both in this case. Yes or no? Because the outlier means that she's far from the regression line. You could imagine a case where your outlier was there, right? It could be that it was far out and that most of them were in this range and that was out there. The outlier might indeed turn out to be on the same line. On the other hand, there's a sense in which it's not surprising if it doesn't, because something's going on here. And you take my arsenic example, all right? If you plotted the effect on mortality of arsenic for very small amounts of arsenic, it would be going down. For large amounts of arsenic, it isn't surprising that something quite different is happening. To take one example, actually, that's of some real-world importance, a lot of, back when nuclear testing was a big issue, there were lots of studies about how many people were dying or how many birth defects were occurring during nuclear testing. And they were all bogus. Because what all of them consisted of doing was taking data from high exposures of radiation and assuming that the effects were just proportional. That if 1,000 units resulted in a 2% increase in cancer, then one unit resulted in a 2/1,000th increase in cancer. We know that's not true, because we've got massive evidence for low-dosage radiation for places like Denver. All right, Denver's a mile in the sky. That means that more of the radiation from cosmic rays gets through to it than gets through to us. We know that it does not have high cancer rates or high birth defect rates. And so it's pretty clear that in that case, what's really going on is something more like that. And people were taking this as if that told you what those were. All right. So in general, you ought, in a sense, to be suspicious of predictions outside range. If almost all your data is in some range, and you then say, well, what does that tell us about what's happening here? Well, it tells you something, but not very much, because it's quite likely that the mechanisms will change as you go on. All right? Anyway, let's see, where were we? So no, the answer is that she could be an outlier within the normal range. You could have somebody like that, or like that, or you could have somebody who was not an outlier and was outside the normal range. Normal range is the range most of your data are in, basically. Limitations of linear regression, similarly to what we've been discussing before, that you could have a close relationship, because in those cases it wasn't linear. For the first one, you can use the same man. It's just that the regression won't be linear. You could say, aha, what's going on is that y equals a plus bx plus cx squared. Why is that what's going on? Because the squared term will have a larger influence as you go out. All right. One squared is only one.
5 squared is 25. So therefore, if you had a negative term for this, if B was negative, the graph starts out going down. If C is positive, after a while, the effect of the squared term becomes higher, and it starts going back up again. So you could try, if you saw that pattern, you might find other ways of fitting it. You could think of plausible equations, and you could do least squares, and that'd be linear, right? You could do a least squares fit for anything. All you're doing is the math, how you do it might not be the same. But logically, you could say, given an equation of this sort, what value of those parameters will minimize the sum squared error? And you can do that in lots of ways. Second basis we discussed, it looks as though we need another variable. And then you could poke around and try to figure out, looking at the data, what it is. All right, the next step is multiple regression. And multiple regression is the same thing we've just been doing, but with more than one independent variable. The dependent variable is the effect. The independent variable is what you suspect of being the cause. Most things have multiple causes. The advantage of the linear regression is that paper has two dimensions, and so you can actually draw the thing on a sheet of paper. If you had two independent variables and three-dimensional blackboard, which one could certainly imagine some way of doing that, you could still draw it, but we don't have any very practical way of doing four dimensions. There are clues that you can use to try to represent it. But so basically, the math is the same whether you have two independent variables or 100 independent variables. So most of us can't think very well in 100 one-dimensional space. So it's harder to intuit what's going on. So imagine that you're thinking that you want to find out whether the death penalty affects the murder rate, but you're sensible enough to realize that even if it does, lots of other things affect the murder rate. So what do? You say, what do I think those things are? You say, well, my guess is that the other two important variables are how much of the population is males 18 to 26, because that tends to be a fraction of the population that is willing to take risks, maybe engage a certain amount of violence. Those are the people who volunteer for the army, crash cars, and kill each other. So you'd like to control for that. You want to know for two populations of the same fraction in principle, what's the effect of death penalty. But you also think the unemployment rate might affect it. Don't know which way it does, but you can certainly imagine that when people are unemployed, they're wandering around with nothing to do, and they get into fights or something. So that's your hypothetical theory. And you could say, all right, that means that what we're saying is M, the murder rate, is a unknown constant, plus something times the death penalty, plus something else times the fraction of the population that's male in that age group, plus something else times the unemployment rate. All right? And your data could be cross-section. You could be saying, all right, each of my data points is a state. So we got 50 states, each of which has a value for M, D, F, and U. So we can just plug those into our statistical program. If we had four-dimensional paper, we could put them in as dots. It could also be longitudinal. We could say, what happens to the state as these circumstances change? So you could take a single state for 50 years. Or it could be both. It could be pooled. You could have the data for 50 states over 50 years, say. It gives you a lot more data points. When you do the pooled data, there are some problems that arise because it's likely that there are some characteristics which are characteristics of a state that stay the same over time, but that you've left out of your regression. So you're going to want to think about how you can control that sort of effect. And for that matter, there might be effects which are specific to a particular year across all states. You might want to try to control for those too. But you get much more complicated versions of the same thing. For example, D might be the fraction of the murderers who were executed, the fraction of people convicted of murder, or the fraction of murderers, that is, the fraction of murderers who were executed could be two different things. It could be the fraction of people convicted who get the death penalty, or it could be the number of people who get the death penalty for murder divided by the number of murders. After all, it's true that if you only execute a small fraction of your convicted murderers, the death penalty doesn't have very much effect. But it's also true that if you only catch a small fraction of the murderers, the death penalty doesn't have much effect either. So you could imagine using either of those.
But furthermore, there's no particular theoretical reason why it should be linear. It might be that increasing the death penalty from, you know, 1 in 100 to 2 in 100 has a bigger effect than increasing over 200 to 3 in 100. You don't know. So you could imagine trying, instead of treating it as D is your variable, D squared is your variable, or square root of D, or some other function of D, which doesn't change linearly. Furthermore, you might argue that the real question is not what the chances of being executed, because the criminals don't know that. The real question is there a death penalty or not? And a lot of people, when they look at these, put it in those terms, and that, I guess, depends on how sophisticated you think the criminals are, whether they can distinguish a death penalty that's practically never enforced, which is what, I guess, most U.S. states with death penalties have. Not all of them. Texas, I guess, is an exception, from a death penalty that doesn't exist at all. Furthermore, it might be that the murder rate this year depends on the current unemployment rate, which is how many young adult males are wandering around with nothing to do, but it depends on last year's death penalty probability, because after all, you wouldn't expect the potential murderer to have really up-to-date data. The question is, does he know someone in the last year or two who actually got executed for murder? Well, that's going to depend on last year more than on this year at some point. So then you would do the statistics, but for the death penalty, instead of using the death penalty in 1990 to go with the murder rate in 1990, you'd use the death penalty in 1989 along with the murder rate, unemployment rate, and number of young adult males for 1990. So there are, if you think about sort of this seriously, and I'm not going to get into it very far, there are lots of ways that the same basic theory, the basic theory is that the murder rate depends on the death penalty, the fraction of the population that's young adult males, and the unemployment rate. That's the theory. And you could think of lots of different regressions, different ways of setting up the relationships, all of which would fit that theory. All right? We could try all of these. Anybody see where I'm going? We could try all of these different ways of doing it, see which one gives the answer we want, and then report that one. All right? So we're back in what I referred to earlier as specification search. The fact that if I know that what I want to do is to prove the death penalty does deter murders, I try every way I can think of doing the regression. One of them gives me a really hot result. Forget about the rest. Obviously, this is the right one. And once I've got it, I can think of some plausible reasons why that was obviously the right one. All right? So that's a potential problem. And that's why if you're really doing this stuff for real and you want people to believe it, death penalty is one of the, I guess, the two that I've actually noticed in the sort of law and econ related literature that get lots of people hot and excited and some serious statisticians arguing with each other. One of them is, does the death penalty deter murder? And the other is, does letting ordinary citizens carry concealed handguns reduce or increase the crime rate? And those are both obviously politically heavily loaded issues. People feel strongly about them. Most people who feel strongly about them don't know anything about statistics and therefore can be persuaded by arguments of various sorts. Actually, one of the places I got interested in this, back when I was a faculty fellow at Chicago, I was talking with one of the professors there who's very much interested in issues like the death penalty, about the work done by a guy called Ehrlich, who was the first person who used a reasonably sophisticated multiple regression approach to figure out whether the death penalty had an effect. And his conclusion was a sizable effect, that each execution on average deterred like 5 murders or something, some number like that. And the person I was talking to, who I should say was a very nice, very intelligent, I would say very honest person, told me with confidence that Ehrlich's work was worthless, that everybody else's results showed the opposite, and that Ehrlich had refused to make available his data so that people could replicate it. And I asked, well, how do you know these things? And he said, well, you know, here's this book that has information on it. So I read the book, which was pretty clearly a collection of articles put together by some of his friends and colleagues, and everything he told me was false. That if you actually read the book, the introduction explained a lot of reasons. First, the book was mainly not on the death penalty in particular, but on whether punishment deterred. And the beginning explained a lot of reasons why it might be that the evidence that punishment deterred was wrong. No evidence, though. That was just why the evidence. And that's perfectly true. I mean, you know, correlation isn't causation. There were then a bunch of articles, essentially all of which concluded that in different areas punishment deterred.
And one of the articles was an article by someone who had replicated Ehrlich's work with Ehrlich's data and again gotten the result of definitely deterred. And I pointed this out to the guy who told me this, and he was sort of apologetic. And it was pretty clear that he knew nothing about statistics. He hadn't even read the book. But friends of his who agreed with his political views had told him that Ehrlich was bunk. And he, of course, wanted to believe Ehrlich was bunk because he was strongly against the death penalty. And this is a strong argument for the death penalty, obviously. And therefore, he had just taken it for granted. And as I say, this was a guy who certainly, just in terms of sort of personal observation, struck me as a unusually nice and honest and honorable guy. But, you know, you can't investigate everything and you believe your friends. Anyway, so, hence some of these problems. So what does running a regression mean? It means finding the values of the A, B1, B2, B3 in there, which result in minimizing the sum of squared deviations. So what we were doing before for the linear regression is finding the value of A and 1B, the slope. Now we're doing it, in effect, in n dimensions. So we're saying that our M equals A plus the first constant times our first independent variable, the second constant times the second independent variable, third constant times the third independent variable. We have data on the M's. Sorry, that middle M is the same, obviously. That ought to be F, if I remember correctly. I accidentally got this one variable twice in there. I shouldn't have. So the I things, the M1, the notice that there's a 1 on the D and an I on the D. Alright, DI means the ith point. Alright, the ith state, say. Or DI, more precisely, is death probability of execution in the ith state. UI is unemployment rate in the ith state. Or maybe the ith year, could be over years or over states. Whereas the B1, B2, B3, B1 goes with death penalty, B2 goes with fraction of young adult males, only I got it wrong there, and B3 goes with unemployment. So each of those is saying how much each of those independent variable affects the dependent variable.
Yep. So does that mean that as B sub x goes up, then the effect of the variable goes up?
If putting it differently, we're not varying them, we're calculating the B's. The data we have are the I's. And we're using that data to find the set of A's and B's which give the closest fit. And the higher B3 is, the greater the effect that unemployment has on the inverted rate. That's right. Exactly. Okay. So here I labels the observations, let's just say in the year, and we're looking for the values of A, B1, B2, and B3 that minimize the sum of squared residuals. All right. And while I'm thinking about it, I think F was what I was calling my second variable, as I remember, for fraction. Why don't I fix that right now? And why don't I save it? I actually end up putting this on the web page. Why is it looking funny? I don't know. But let's go back to here and go back to the slideshow, which is here. Somehow got ahead. There we are. Running a regression means doing this. And next question is, what are the equivalent of our earlier significance results? And the answer is, we observed that some coefficient, for example, is positive. For example, that in predicting the wages of the employees of this firm, which we suspect of discrimination, whites get paid more than blacks. And that whites get paid more than blacks, controlling for all the other factors in the regression. So if it's a wage one, maybe the other factors are how long have they been working here and what's their education. And therefore, if the coefficient on race turns out positive, say race is defined as 1 if you're white and 0 if you're black, say, if the coefficient on that is positive, that is at least some evidence that not only that whites are paid more than blacks, but that whites are paid more than blacks with the same age, with the same education, the same experience. Because we've already got those other two things in, yes.
That means if you have two variables, one tending to affect the other one, like where two variables move together.
Got a real problem.
But using this, you should be able to separate out the effects, right?
Very hard, because the problem is that when you observe that something that your dependent variable goes up, how do you know which of the two independent variables made it go up? So the answer is yes in principle, but no in practice. The closer they are to being the same, I'll come to that in a minute, the harder it is to figure out what the separate effect of each one is. Because each one, as it were, is mostly masquerading the other. A different way of putting it is that the measure we're going to come up with shortly is a measure of how much the fit improves when you add a variable. But if you've got one variable that already has almost all the same information as the other, then the fit isn't going to improve very much when you add the second one. There's a particular case of this which I actually spent some time on, because a year or two ago, not professionally, but I was curious and looking at it, which had to do with studies of predicting success in University of California. And that, again, it was a political element which made me suspicious, although I'm not entirely sure my suspicions were justified. But what was going on was the University of California had been instructed, I think, by a ballot initiative, or maybe it was a court decision, I'm not sure, not to engage in affirmative action, not to discriminate in favor of blacks in particular admissions. The University of California pretty clearly wanted to, for whatever ideological. And it occurred to some clever person that if you de-emphasized SAT exams and increased the emphasis on class standing in high school, since poor people from poor areas are mostly going to high schools where the other kids are poor people from poor areas, class standing for poor people, in a sense, assuming they were perfectly segregated that way that kind of thing, the top student in the slum class would get the same qualification for getting in as the top student in the elite suburb, even though probably the top student in the slum class is not nearly as good, almost certainly won't have as high an SAT exam. So they wanted to have arguments for using class rank rather than SAT, and they did some fairly extensive statistical studies which at least purported to show that SAT did not do a very good job of predicting success in college in some measure. Graduated in 4 years, or what your grades were in first year, I don't know, a number of different measures. And at least one of the ones I was suspicious of, one of the variables they were controlling for was parental income. They said, after all, rich kids are likely to do better on the SAT than poor kids, they've got better schools, they've got more coaching, and so forth, so therefore we want to control for parental income and then see what happens. Well, if you control for parental income, the predictive power of the SAT goes down a lot because the SAT scores correlate fairly well with parental income. And therefore, the parental income is already telling you this kid will do better in school than that kid will. Well, we also know, in addition to having richer parents, you also have higher SAT. That doesn't add very much information. Now, I don't think that was true of all of them. I think this was a while ago, so it wasn't very. I think when I looked at it, I finally concluded that I couldn't convincingly dismiss their results on that kind of grounds. But it certainly was something to be suspicious about and looking at it. And it's an interesting question, quite aside from the affirmative action thing. If you just think about how colleges should decide who to admit, it's far from clear what the relevant measures are. And their claim, at least, was that class standing was a better predictor than SAT exam.
So given a very large data set, even like kids in high school,
yes,
or given a sufficiently large data set, you should be able to
given enough data, you can tease out things that are otherwise hard to tease out. That's right.
Okay. But even like a medium-sized, whatever that means, set of data, it could be very difficult to...
If the things are closely collinear. The case I mentioned later, which is the extreme case, where it doesn't matter how much data you have, is one of your variables is temperature and centigrade and one in Fahrenheit.
Then it's example.
They're perfect predictors of each other, and each of those will give you zero by itself, a zero addition if the other's already in.
Right.
That's the limited case, exactly. So how do you get confidence results? And the answer is that you use something called a t-test. And what a t-test is, it's analogous to a z-test. It's not the same thing. But what t is the size of the coefficient relative to a measure of how uncertain the coefficient is, which is called the standard error.
So if t, so if the coefficient is 4, but the appropriate analysis, well, is 4 plus or minus 5, loosely speaking, then your t is less than 1, that's not very strong evidence it's positive, is what you want to know in this case. On the other hand, if the coefficient is 5 and its standard error is 1, that's roughly like being 5 standard deviations from the mean. It's not exactly the same, but it's an analogous kind of evidence, and that's quite strong evidence. So therefore, when you are using a regression and you want to get confidence results, you say, what is the t-value for this coefficient? And the regression program will probably print that. But if it didn't, what you would be doing is look at the size of the coefficient, and your program should tell you how uncertain. It should have a measure which is like a standard deviation, only it's a measure of how different that coefficient could be from the value with, you know, reasonable likelihood. And then you look it up in a t-table, like a z-table, and the one complication, which I'm not sure I want to go into in much detail, is what are called degrees of freedom. And the basic logic of the degrees of freedom problem is, suppose you have only 2 data points, and you do a straight linear regression. How well will you fit the data? What?
Very well.
Perfectly. If you're 2 points, you can draw one straight line. All right? So that means that the fact that you get a good fit with 2 variables and 2 data points tells you nothing at all about whether anything is really going on. It's guaranteed. So therefore, what you really want to know is you want to include in your t-table what is the number of data points above the number of variables. That in effect, if you have n variables, you can always get a perfect fit to n plus 1 data points, as in one variable to 2 points. And given that, it's only the, as it were, the points above that that count. And that's where degrees of freedom come in. All right, perfectly. And this is somebody's nice description. Give me enough parameters and I'll pick the skyline of New York. And that doesn't mean the skyline of New York is really described by a regression equation. It just means enough parameters, you can fit anything. Somebody else's version is, you know, with 8 parameters I'll fit a dog, and with 9 I'll make him wag his tail. And that basic point, with lots of parameters you get what look like good fits, even though there's nothing really there. How do you decide what variables to include in your regression from all the ones? First, you're limited to ones you've got data on, and second, you want ones that might be relevant to the murder rate, if that's what you're studying. And one approach is trial by error. So you say, here are 9 different variables. Let's try each one all by itself. Which one gives the best R-squared? Which one explains the largest amount of the variance? Aha, that's our best one. But you could then keep going. You could say, well, all right, we've decided that the thing that explains the largest amount of variance is the percentage of the population that's males 19 to 26. So let's put that in as our first as one of our independent variables. Now try adding each of the others to see how much additional R squared, how much that improves our fit. And you could keep doing that for as many variables as you want. And there are computer programs that will do that. And then the problem is the one that we've already seen in lots of cases, that if there are lots of ways you could do it, then by pure chance, one of them is likely to give you a pretty good fit, and the fact that the fit is unlikely to happen by chance is highly misleading. If unlikely to happen by chance means if you only tried one, but you tried 20 or 30 or 40. So that's it. Some more problems about how to cheat, and we've run through misstated meaning and significance, use a biased sample, select which to report, use unreliable data. But there are some new ways. The plaintiff claims that aspartame causes cancer. And you, or the defense lawyer, says, we ran a regression. The independent variables were age, gender, use of diet, drinks, and aspartame consumption. And what do you know? Putting in aspartame consumption doesn't significantly improve the ability to predict how old you die. What's wrong with that? What has he done almost certainly deliberately in order to get that result? You know the answer. You've just been telling us the answer.
Sorry.
Do you know what aspartame is?
I wouldn't listen to the examples.
Right.
Diet, drinks.
aspartame was in diet drinks. So what has he done? When a variable that already contains aspartame consumption, namely how much diet drinks do you have, once you've got that in, it's like my centigrade Fahrenheit example, just not quite as extreme, adding in aspartame consumption, of course, isn't going to give you a significant result. All right?
Because it's adding almost no new information to what you already have. Prostate one, I'm going to come back to this in a little bit. Defense claims his prostate medicine doesn't shorten life, which is what he's being sued for. And the plaintiff says, my regression shows a strong correlation between whether you use prostate medication and when you die, more likely to use prostate medication, die younger, and what are the variables, state of residency, race, and use of prostate medicine. Any guess as to, we'll come back to that in a little, because there are a couple of things wrong with that, which are sort of interesting. I'll come back to this. So the collinearity problem, which is what we've just been talking about, is that your significance calculation is based on how much better you fit the data by adding this variable. And you would get zero significance if adding the variable only improves the fit by which the amount by which by random chance one more variable will let you improve the fit, lets you fit one more point into that. And as I say, if you included both the temperature in Fahrenheit and the temperature in centigrade, once you've got one, putting in the other doesn't improve your fit at all because they're exactly proportional to each other. They have exactly the same information. The t-test is asking how many standard deviations out the coefficient is, which depends on how precisely you know the coefficient, because that gives those standard deviations. And in the centigrade Fahrenheit case, heating oil consumption equals A plus B times the temperature in Fahrenheit plus C times the temperature in centigrade. And I can do exactly the same fit, leaving out either one of those two temperatures, because they have the same number, except for one of them is a constant times the other plus a constant. Is that argument clear? Yes, no? This is what this fancy term collinearity means. You've got two variables that are collinear, meaning they vary roughly together. And in this case, they're perfectly collinear. Yeah?
So is that just telling me if you're trying to explain what effects certain independent variables have on a dependent variable, if those independent variables are collinear, then you're not going to make a prediction about which one.
In that case, you could get lots of information by including one instead of none. But not much information by adding, once one is there, adding another. Because, for one thing, you can't tell whether the one you added, putting it differently, you could have a case where both of them together explain 50% of the variance. Each one of them added to the other explains 2% of the variance. Because whichever you add, you put in first, does the first 48%. And then the other one adds another couple of percent. All right.
So that's a problem, and that's a reason why when you're picking variables, you would like, if possible, to find ones that aren't closely related to each other. All right. And if you add a variable that correlates closely with another, that decreases the significance of the other one, because the new one explains most of the same. So let's take the case I mentioned a moment ago. You want to prove that prostate medicine, particular prostate medicine, causes shorter life. You leave out a variable that correlates with both. This is the omitted variable problem. This is sort of the flip side of this. I was giving, this is not the collinearity problem. This is the one I was having one slide earlier than that. Prostate medicine is only used by men because women don't have prostate glands, let alone enlarged prostate glands, which elderly men, alas, tend to have. Men have shorter life expectancies than women. So if you took a random sample of the population, simply the fact that all the people using prostate medicine are men would make it look as though prostate medicine resulted in a shorter life. All right? So it looks as though the independent variable, which is prostate medicine, is predicting the dependent variable length of life, but really independent variable is predicting gender, and gender predicts length of life. There is a second problem with this particular experiment. What's the other reason? Suppose you limited your sample to men. You say, aha, we're not going to make that mistake. And sure enough, you find that use of prostate medicine still correlates with dying earlier. Now what's the mistake? Yeah?
Could it be that people that are using prostate medicine are unhealthier to begin with?
Yeah, they got an enlarged prostate. They may have prostate cancer, depending on the particular case. Exactly. That
using the mix. It's not like you're randomly picking people having... The way you do this when you're doing a serious experiment or testing a drug is you randomly assign half the people the drug and half the people the placebo, the thing which as far as they know, could be the drug, but is nothing, basically. And when people self-select, you have to figure out have they self-selected on some basis relevant to how early they'll die, and the answer is yes. In this case, you only use prostate medicine if you have prostate problems. Now, how big the effect would be, I'm not sure. As it happens, the problem, which is very, very common, which probably almost all of the males in this room will eventually suffer from unless medicine improves in the meanwhile, or unless you die young, is only an inconvenience. What people worry about is prostate cancer, but even there, it turns out there are basically two kinds. There's a rare kind of prostate cancer which kills you fairly quickly, and there's a common kind of prostate cancer which kills you slowly enough that the advice is often don't bother to treat it. You will have died of old age before it kills you. So it's not like there's a close connection to this particular case, but there is going to be some connection, so it is in principle. What else correlates with both prostate medication and life expectancy, whether or not you have prostate problems. All right, I mentioned briefly before Furman v. Georgia, famous case, and for some reason this watch keeps getting to the wrong place. But that's a sort of a famous example which involved this case that temporarily abolished the death penalty, also used the statistics, and so they had data on all the capital cases, or at least all the capital convictions, I think, in the state of Georgia over some period of time. And as I think I mentioned, a lot of people who've heard of this case think what it showed was that black murderers were more likely to get executed than white murderers. In fact, it's just the opposite. Black defendants had a lower probability of execution than white defendants. I'm not positive whether defendants means convicted defendants or defendants in general. I'd have to go back and read it, which I did a long time ago. What was really going on, the critical thing, was controlling for the race of the victim. Because a black who killed a black was more likely to be executed than a white who killed a black. A black who killed a white was more likely to be executed than a white who killed a white. However, someone who killed a black was much less likely to be executed than someone who killed a white. And blacks mostly kill blacks, and whites mostly kill whites. Most murder is intra-racial. And the result of that was that even though if you held the race of the victim constant, blacks were more likely to be executed. If you ignored race of victim, blacks were less likely to be executed. Is that logic of that clear? Because it's an interesting case where you sort of, in a sense, is an example of the fact that facts don't speak for themselves. That if all you said was, if you are convicted of murder in Georgia, how likely are you to be executed if you're a black? How likely a white? You get the wrong answer. That you get the factually right answer would tell you the wrong thing. And in fact, if you looked at the data, the discrimination against black defendants was not very high. I think it was maybe a 10% higher chance or something. The discrimination against black victims was very high. Again, I remember the numbers. There was a much larger effect. So that if you were a black who killed a black, your chances of being executed weren't very high. Well, they were a little higher than if you were a white who killed a black. But they were much lower than if you were anybody who killed a white, basically. Now, I'm not a lawyer. I wondered at the time if the argument should have been made in terms of equal protection. The argument being that the reason to have the death penalty is to deter, and if you selectively apply it by the race of the victim, then you're providing less deterrence for killing blacks than for killing whites, and that's not equal protection. But whether that would actually apply for a court, I don't know. I don't think that was the argument that was made. Significance and standard of proof. The book discusses a wage discrimination case, and the coefficient on the race effect was non-zero, but it wasn't large enough to make the 0.05 level of significance. And the footnote suggests, since it's a civil case, maybe 0.05 is too strong a requirement. Should it have been 0.5? Civil case is supposed to be decided by the preponderance of the evidence. Anybody who says yes gets flogged with a wet noodle. Because that's what we were just discussing at the beginning, the fact that that 0.5 is not the probability that the firm discriminated, is the probability that the evidence would be this strong if they didn't discriminate. So it does not, in fact, tell you the probability. You need more information. And I don't think the book actually makes the mistake, although I think it's certainly hinting at the mistake. And I don't know. I suppose if I see Steve Chagall one of these days, I should push him on whether or not he was correctly making that distinction or not. All right, this is what we'll be talking about next time, so I'm just going to give you a brief preview of it. It's sort of fun. The law school would like to raise the bar passage rate, and we'd like to do it for at least two quite different reasons. One of them is that the higher our bar passage rate, the higher we will be rated by U.S. News and World Report, and the more smart students will come here, and the more money they're willing to pay us to come here, and stuff like that. So the school, for its own selfish reasons. But also because it really is not a very good thing to have somebody spend huge amounts of money and 3 years of time and then in order to learn how to be a lawyer and not be able to be a lawyer because you can't pass the bar. So there are reasons why it would be nice to pass the bar, to raise the bar passage rate. And suppose we have data on all the students for some substantial number of years. What do we know about them when they apply? What courses do they take? What grades did they get? And what happened to them on the bar? The question is, how would you use that to improve bar passage rate? And I hope it will occur to you that there are at least two different strategies involved with different implications, and try to figure out how to use both. But we're running out of time, so I will leave it there. Yes?
Could you explain the t-test again?
Sure. The t-test is...
First of all, it's defined by the correlation coefficient divided by the...
No, not the correlation coefficient. The regression coefficient. The regression coefficient is that V1, V2, V3. So the question is, how likely is it that this particular independent variable positively affects the dependent variable? And we say, well, according to our regression, every time the independent variable goes up by 1, the dependent variable goes up by 3. That sounds like it's affecting it. But how sure are we it's affecting it? We want to know how confident that 3 is. That 3 is our estimate of the effect of that particular dependent variable on the independent variable. All right. But depending on how good the data are and what else is going on, that 3 might mean, well, 3 is our best estimate. But, you know, it could be 0, it could be 5. If it could easily be 0, it could just be that it came out as 3 because of the particular sample we chose, then we don't have much confidence that it's affecting it. If we're saying it's 3, it could be 2.5, it could be 3.5, but that's about the plausible range. Now we have very strong reasons to believe that's affecting it. So the T is the ratio of the size of the regression coefficient, not the correlation coefficient, the regression coefficient, to a measure of the uncertainty of the regression coefficient.
So, is it the ratio of... I understand the... conceptually, I understand what you're saying. You're saying, it's the ratio of the variable... I'm sorry, how much change you get to the amount of certainty you have.
About how much change.
About that change.
That's right. You could imagine that we've got a particular population, and we draw at random samples of 100 people and do regressions on each sample. And we're not going to get the same numbers each time. Sometimes one sample, B2, turns out to be 3, one turns out to be 2, one turns out to be 4. You can use statistics to figure out how big that variation is going to be. And you can say, what's the standard deviation of the coefficients? You can then say, well, what we really want to know is the coefficient bigger than 0? Does this thing cause that? If that's what we want to know, then we want to know how many standard deviations away from 0 this coefficient is. Just as in earlier stuff we were doing, we wanted to know half standard deviations away from the mean something was.
Good. So the coefficient would be expressed in the form that we had seen earlier, A plus B sub 1 times...
B1 would be one such coefficient, B2 would be one such coefficient, B3 would be one such coefficient.
Gotcha. Okay.
And of course, they will have units. Those are not pure numbers, because if the dependent variable is rainfall and the independent variable is temperature, then there are going to be units in that coefficient of inches of rain per degree of temperature, say, in order that you can get one end to the other.